We have two speakers whose backgrounds might seem it to be counterintuitive that they became advocates for dope smokers. Keith Strop grew up in a Republican family in southern Illinois, in Dix, Illinois. Population 200 now. It's gone down, plummeted. 8 miles from where I grew up in southern Illinois. In fact, his mom and dad had a farm across the street from my aunt and uncle. I didn't know what was growing on that farm besides corn and soybeans
on
cable, apparently. Anyway, they attended a church next door to the yep. Osborne Funeral Home and Furniture Parlor. I've always thought that was an interesting combination. They get you from cradle to grave there. We went to the same high school, but he was in my sister's class, and we didn't know each other until about, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago when I met him on an airplane. He worked as an intern for a Republican United States senator named Avery Dirksen while he was at Georgetown Law School, has a political science degree from the University of Illinois. And then in the early 1970s, he founded the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Law. It's normal to smoke pot. And in some ways, it's kind of a cultural icon. He's been profiled a lot of places, and he was executive director of Normal in two stints, divided by a time when he lobbied for family farmers and met a guy named Willie Nelson and helped Willie lobby for family farmers, and then went back to Normal, and then 2 or 3 years ago retired from Normal and couldn't stay retired. So he became virtually a full-time consultant, still working on this issue. And walking into the room now, right now, fresh from Union Station. I'm just starting to we've been talking about some stuff, and I just started the introductions.
Hello,
Jessica.
Nice to see you.
It's
always my pleasure, dear.
Okay. Hey, Jessica. And let me finish Keith's introduction, then I'll go to you, Jessica. And he couldn't stay out of the marijuana business, and he still lobbies at Normal for an end to. I'm not going to even pretend as the moderator of this nonpartisan, non-ideological organization to be neutral here. The madness of neo-prohibition, and specifically marijuana, which has been smoked by, I don't know, over half the adult population at one time or another, meaning over half the adult population of America could be thrown in jail if we applied the laws fairly and equally, as opposed to the way we applied the laws to the youthful experimenters, Al Gore and Bill Clinton and George W. Bush and a panoply of others, including some who weren't able to make it to the Supreme Court because they admitted their youthful experimentation. So Keith comes from this from a conservative family, conservative Republican family. And our other speaker, Jessica Pat Corey, who I am pleased to say sat where you were sitting in the winter spring of 2000 as a member of that class of the politics and journalism semester. She interned at CNN, political unit, stayed in journalism for a while, and then became a GOP political consultant, political strategist in Denver after she got her law degree. It seems that a lot of members of my classes have gone on to get law degrees, and she has been a writer and a blogger in Denver, and she, her husband, what's your husband's first name?
Rob
Corey, is also an attorney who represents medical marijuana interests, particularly in California, I assume.
And
Colorado, but he does a lot in California
yeah.
also, which yeah. is obviously a hotbed of medical marijuana. And they together now are the token conservative right columnists for the Huffington Post. They figure they needed a conservative or some conservatives for the left liberal Huffington Post just to show that they're a real news organization, I guess. In any case, she has become active, very active, as a libertarian conservative, as a mother of two, as a Republican libertarian spokesman for legalization of marijuana. In fact, she was on Fox News just a week ago Sunday, and she was the subject of a column by Kathleen Parker of the Washington Post several weeks ago So I asked her and Keith to get together on this. She's spoken with Normal's operations and has, as I say, become an emerging voice from the Libertarian Republican side. To complement what I assume you're a Democrat now, aren't you, Keith?
Yes, I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal. Yeah, he moved from that conservative Republican family to liberalism, but both have strong libertarian sensibilities on this subject. Now, before I introduce the topic, let's ask you to tell our speakers who you are, beginning with Jake.
Hey, I'm Jake Carpenter. I'm a senior at Michigan State University, and I'm interning with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch.
Hi, I'm Anthony. I just graduated from the University of Colorado, and I'm at the Washington Times.
I'm Michelle Price. I'm at Arizona State University, and I'm interning at the Hotline.
Daniel Newhouse, also at Arizona State, and I'm at the National Law Journal.
I'm Alex Harden. I go to Georgetown University, and then I'm interning at Tribune.
My name is Alex Besson, and I just finished a year-long stint with the Canadian Foreign Service.
I'm Noman Merchant. I just graduated from Northwestern, and I work for the Wall Street Journal.
I'm Meredith Simons. I graduated from the University of Oklahoma, and I work for the Houston Chronicle.
I'm Lindsay Gordon. I graduated from Washington State University, and I'm with Hearst.
I'm Janiah Plattenberg. Just graduated with my master's from the University of Alabama, and I'm with Bloomberg Television.
Okay, today we're going to talk about the politics of the drug war, a form of interest group politics, because we're going to be talking about lobbying against the second version of prohibition, neo-prohibition, the first prohibition being the prohibition of alcohol in the 1920s. Neo-prohibition was declared by Richard Nixon, who declared a war on drugs. Richard Nixon in the Watergate tapes can be heard to say something very close to this quote. You know, we have a drink to relax, but those hippies smoke marijuana to get high. He didn't seem to understand that was a distinction without a difference, and he actually did a lot of relaxing in his last year or two in office when he apparently drank like a fish during the White House, but as far as we know, smoked no marijuana. Neo-prohibition has now been around for several decades. It was given another hyping in the 1980s with Nancy Reagan's Just Say No to Drugs. And it has become a multi-billion dollar industry, the drug war industrial complex, as many of us call it. And I would note, again, and not at all being neutral on this subject, that alcohol did not create Al Capone and all of his violence. Prohibition created Al Capone. Cocaine, marijuana, and the bathtub gin of neo-prohibition, crystal methamphetamine, do not create drug cartels in Colombia or Mexico and all the violence associated with them. America's war on drugs creates drug cartels. We're going to begin by my asking both Keith and Jessica how they got involved in this issue, just briefly if you can explain it, since again both one started out as a Republican, one is a Republican, and then we want to go to asking Keith to give us some history of how we got where we are right now and how there was momentum and setback and perhaps momentum again, and then ask Jessica what she is attempting to do inside the Republican Party to try to make Republicans understand that this is not some left liberal hippie issue. Begin with you, Keith. How did you get involved in this subject?
Well, it had to do with the anti-war movement. I was coming out of law school in 1968 at the height of the Vietnam War. I was at Georgetown, where one of you is, I think. And back then, all men were eligible for the draft. You didn't get a number. You were eligible by your age. And the minute you were not, didn't have a full-time student's deferment, you were drafted. So when I first got out of law school, I got my draft notice and I passed the physical, and I was two weeks, I think, away from going in. When I managed to get what was called a critical skills deferment, it was a provision in the draft code that said if the work you were doing at home was so important to the, quote, health, safety, and welfare of the nation, then you could serve your 2 years there. I was actually hired by a presidential commission that had been created because of Ralph Nader's work. It was called the National Commission on Product Safety. I frankly don't think it had anything much to do with the health, safety, and welfare of the nation, but at any event, it was good enough for my draft board to give me the deferment. So instead of being in Vietnam getting my ass shot off as a first lieutenant, which is what all lawyers were made automatically back then, you know, follow me, and they were all getting killed. I was at 16th and K, where I work now, but just a few doors down, and I was working very closely with Ralph Nader. So there, here comes the connection. The anti-war movement did two things. It radicalized a lot of us, not just over our foreign policy, but we began to question other values that our older generation were expecting us to adhere to. And at those major anti-war demonstrations, I will tell you, grass was passed around. It's like at a rock concert might be now. You'd be sitting there with people twice your age, and they didn't have to smoke, but they just passed it on. There were joints. There were hundreds of joints being passed around any time I was at a demonstration. Now, in addition, the one thing working close to Ralph did was it taught me the basics of consumer politics. Before Ralph Nader, most of us did not consider consumers to be a legitimate political constituency. Ralph defined them as such, especially started off with unsafe cars, you know, unsafe at any speed, about the Corvair was his first book, and then he branched out to other products. And the commission I worked for, it was a two-year presidential commission, but nobody had ever heard of us. So when they wrote about dangerous products, they wrote Ralph. He'd been in the news. So we would go to Ralph's office a few blocks away every day and read his mail, and then we would decide what products to schedule public hearings on and see if we could propose legislation. At the end of that 2 years, I was old enough I could not be drafted. I was then 29, so I was free to actually look for a real job. And it appeared to me the issue that my generation was mostly impacted by was marijuana. Most of us had smoked at some point by then. More and more people, but back then it was maybe 250,000, 300,000 people a year were being arrested. Today it's 750, I'm sorry to say. But nonetheless, it was the biggest cultural problem my generation faced. And so it occurred to me that I'd like to do consumer politics like Ralph was, but not product safety. I wanted to legalize marijuana, and so that is precisely how and why I started Normal.
And what year was that?
That was in late 1970, and one other little thing, too. Ramsey Clark, who had been our attorney general, but who had left by that point and was a peace nut by then, he and Jane Fonda were going over to Vietnam, you remember all of that stuff. I managed to get in to see Ramsey Clark because, you know, a young lawyer, I wasn't sure this seemed to some of my friends. They were warning me, advising me this was self-destructive. This is crazy. I'd have a terrible life and a terrible career. And I went to talk to Ramsey Clark and took a while, but when I finally got in to see him, he had an enormous influence on me, and he ended up being on the advisory board of Normal for a decade or so. But during those early months, he says, number one, do it because it's important and it needs to be done. We got to quit treating marijuana smokers like criminals. Number two, he said, do it now while you're young because as you get older, you'll have responsibilities that make it impossible for you to go out on these flights of fancy. And I think both pieces of advice were bright and good, and it certainly reinforced me enough that I quit my job and founded Normal.
Jessica, how did you get involved in this issue?
Well, first I want to say that it was actually the Washington Center for Politics and Journalism because Carrie Mae Ponywas, who's now Carrie Mae Ponywas Bjorkvist, isn't that a great name, who's become a lawyer like so many of us, unfortunately, she would not shut up about the drug war. I was like, girlfriend, we're out at a bar. Like, let's just let it go. She was part of Families Against Mandatory Minimums. Having been one of the 93 million Americans who had smoked pot, I thought, okay, you're right, but what's the big deal? And so it was sort of through this educational process. She's an extremely liberal Democrat. I'm very fiscally conservative, obviously libertarian on social issues. So that was really the moment of awakening for me when she started to talk
about... Carrie Mae perhaps hear Keith speak here? Possibly, yeah.
I'm sorry?
Carrie Mae might have heard Keith speak. He's been speaking for years here, right?
Yeah, I think I would have remembered you, though.
Yeah, I don't
I mean,
know if I
can't forget
spoke.
This one.
No.
We're in the same class, so... I don't know. We'll have to do some research. I would never forget you, Keith.
Oh, that's very sweet.
So, originally, when I told Terry I was coming out, and he said, oh, well, let's bring you in, we were supposed to talk about... blogging and marketing yourself. And I'm still technically a working journalist. I have credentials. Write for Human Events, which is on the far right, and Huffington Post, which is the far left. And I do syndicated columns across the Rocky Mountain West. So I love it. It's the perfect life. And
she, I should forgot to tell you, and I should tell you this, she has been called by one of Colorado's most influential women by the Denver Examiner, and in 2007 she was named Colorado's top political, one of Colorado's top political movers and shakers by the Colorado Statesman. So she is famous in Colorado and increasingly famous in America.
I love you, Terry. So we were going to talk about blogging and marketing, because what's journalism today? And you can't hide behind a byline, right? And so it is with great interest that I find that here I am talking about marijuana, medical marijuana, legalization in general, because I am this anti-affirmative action Republican, and yet I find it is the irony of this Republican mom with two kids coming at Don't Smoke Pot Today, coming out in favor of legalization. And so what I would like to talk a little bit about in terms of coverage of the drug war and related issues is looking for those ironies and looking for those spokesmen and seeing what appeals to you in terms of what kind of coverage you're going to give the issue, and whether or not you accept the status quo. Do you accept the Centers for Disease Control or the Bureau of Labor Statistics and all of this propaganda that's out there about marijuana? And so through this program, I started to take a very serious look at these statistics. You know, we hear the gateway drug argument that if you smoke marijuana, you're going to, you know, have a 30% chance of doing heroin. Well, 100% of the people who've done heroin have also breathed air and, you know, eaten a hamburger in their life. So then should hamburgers and breathing be prohibited?
You know, so use this drug, too.
Exactly. Oh, my God. I've had about 4 Diet Cokes already today. So the larger point being, when we get into this, I do want to talk about the coverage to challenge each one of those statistics, because that's what this program taught me. But to get back to how I ended up here, I ran for the Colorado Senate in 2004 at the age of 25, almost took down a 2-term incumbent. She outspent us 4-1. I ran on a property rights platform. I do higher ed and property rights, which makes it that much more ironic that here I am. If you would have told me 10 years ago, you're going to be out there nationally as a spokeswoman for marijuana legalization, I would have said you're crazy. So to bring it back to my campaign, I'm running, and my husband, very libertarian Republican, was out there championing the anti-prohibition movement. And I kept getting these calls from these lobbyists and people in my party saying, get your husband to shut up. Get your husband to shut up. Well, I'm in a marriage of mutual respect and honesty and intellectual integrity, and I wasn't going to tell my husband to shut up. But I also wasn't truly honest with myself in the sense that I didn't come out. Of course, when you run for office, you have to pick and choose, right? But during that campaign, I became pregnant with my first daughter. So I won, ultimately, because I got a beautiful... Now I have 2 beautiful babies, but I got my first beautiful baby out of it. And I just started to get more upset because there were all these people who said, you'll change your mind about the drug war once you have your kids. You'll see. You're going to need the government. And in fact, when I became a parent, I didn't become less libertarian. I became more libertarian. And I started to think critically about the billions of dollars we spend every year on a failed prohibition experiment. And when people say to me, well, you know, you're endorsing marijuana use by your kids' own marijuana use, they're going to turn into druggies just to spite you. And damn the day they find Google, obviously. But I think honesty is a very important component of raising any child, something I didn't have in my childhood. So that's where I'm starting my relationship with my children. But I wrote about this growth in a Denver Post column about how everybody tells you when you have children, your political ideology is going to change. And I wrote about the drug war. As a mother, the column ran on my daughter's first birthday, talking about how I wanted the government to get out of my house, let me be the parent, and stop spending billions of dollars to put 850,000 otherwise law-abiding Americans into our criminal justice system every year. And so in response to that column, Karen Tandy, who was then George W. Bush's DEA chief, wrote a scathing letter to the editor talking about how I was exploiting my children for a larger political cause. My response, perhaps, is somewhat predictable, which was, Karen, you're exploiting my children. You are exploiting my children and my role as a parent to perpetuate an industry, multi-billion-dollar industry, that is funded by our tax dollars to prohibit a substance that is far less harmful than alcohol, cheeseburgers, or cigarettes. So that's sort of where I've come from. This summer, wrote a column in a small Colorado newspaper called the Colorado Daily, circulation of 30,000. Well, the editor changed the title to Republican Moms for Marijuana.
last time I checked, there were 12 pages on Google of blogs that had Republican moms for marijuana. So in terms of when you think about your coverage, and this is just a quick aside, and then I swear I'll shut up, you know, those little columns, those little newspaper opportunities, given the current media environment, don't pass those up, because one day you could be writing for a tiny little newspaper in northern Michigan, and the next thing you know, you have this national audience. So work hard on that, and I guess I look forward to vibrant conversation.
Okay, Daily Marijuana
Daryl,
Smoker.
Daily, you know Carl Sagan was the astronomer. Daily Marijuana. Apparently it does not really destroy brilliant minds. Let me say, to follow up on something that Jessica said about news coverage of this subject, perhaps the greatest colluders in the drug war are the people who run your news organizations, First Amendment organizations that are supposed to stand for individual liberty. What they do is virtually rewrite press releases from the Partnership for a Freedom of Free America, I'm sorry, the Partnership for a Drug-Free America, and they give the president's drug czar free advertising pages in return for paid advertising pages under federal law. I think the program is just about ended now. But they would they ever give the Department of Defense, if they bought an ad touting mission accomplished, a free page of advertising for the accomplishment of that other war? Keith, would you now give us a little history of what's happened since you started Normal and the progress and then the setback, and perhaps maybe we're seeing more progress now?
Yes, in fact, I'll be fairly brief on the early years just because I think it's more important to talk about where we are now and in particular the role that women are beginning to play in a much more important role at ending this prohibition, just as they did alcohol prohibition. For any of you who are students of that period of history, you will see that there were several women's organizations that played a leading role, and I see that happening right now in this country as well, and I'm delighted people like Jessica. We're starting something at Normal, by the way. Jessica and a number of other heavy-hitting women are involved in, called Normal Women, and I think you'll be seeing a good bit more about them over the coming months. Normal's basic position has always been there's absolutely nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana by adults, and it should be of no interest or concern to the government. It's just we don't want the government coming into our house to know what books we read, what music we listen to, how we conduct ourselves in the privacy of the bedroom, or whether we drink alcohol or smoke marijuana when we relax at night. I don't care whether you're liberal or conservative. We don't want the government in that part of our private lives. So that's been Normal's basic position. From 1970 to 1977 were the early good years for this issue. The Marijuana Commission had been created in 1972. It was a subsection of the Controlled Substances Act of 1970, set up a two-year study group. And people were somewhat surprised in 72 when they came out with a report saying we ought to stop arresting marijuana smokers. This was a commission created by Nixon. Nixon appointed half the members, and Congress created half the members. Nixon was so pissed off when this report came back saying we ought to decriminalize minor marijuana offenses, he refused to even allow the commission to come to the White House to present the report. They had to mail it in. That's the truth. Wow. Nixon was not a nice person, not that I ever met him, but at any event. So we had some terrific support, not for legalizing marijuana. Legalizing usually means something like alcohol, where you regulate its sale, you have age controls, you tax it, but it's the only way you get control over a drug is by legalizing it. The commission didn't have the courage to go that far, but what they said was, let's at least stop arresting smokers, because smokers make up 90% of the arrests that occur, and they still do. It's usually between 88 and 89% of all arrests, and there are something like 850,000 every year in this country. 88, 89% are people like you and me. They smoke marijuana, that's it. So, armed with that, Normal began to take a cadre of expert witnesses around from state to state to testify in favor of the need to decriminalize, was the word that came out of that, decriminalize minor marijuana offenses in these various states. And there were lots of young legislators who were coming along about that time, just elected to the legislature, who were also sensitive to this issue. Now, most older state legislators, you can imagine, in the 70s, they were reefer maniacs. They thought it led to heroin. So it wasn't easy. But between 1970 and 1977, we successfully decriminalized minor marijuana offenses in 11 states, beginning with Oregon in 72, ending with Nebraska in 77. We thought we were on a plane, man, and we were about to win this thing. I am embarrassed continually when people come up with quotes of myself in the mid and late 70s when they said, how long do you think it'll be before we'll have marijuana legalized? And I used to say, it might take us 10 years. Well, here we are. It's been 39 years, and we've still got a little work to do. But what I didn't realize, political currents don't go in a straight line. They go for a while, and then the pendulum swings back the other way. And when it begins to swing against you, about all you can do is keep your head down and try to protect the gains you made when it was heading in your direction. You sure as hell can't make any more gains. We won 11 states between 1970 and 1977. We did not win another single state from 77 until 96. 18 years, folks. That is a long goddamn time to be losing. I am happy to say we also didn't lose a state. It was close. In a number of states, they fought like heck to come back and try to recriminalize. We managed to hold on to those 11. As of 96, the issue that began to surface was the medical use of marijuana. The medical use of marijuana was a minor issue during the earlier years, but by the mid-90s, it had become a major issue, and California, by voter initiative, adopted Prop 215, which legalized the medical use of marijuana in California if a doctor recommended its usage. Beginning with that victory, we now have a total of 14 states that have legalized medical use. We have an additional 2 states that have decriminalized marijuana, being Nevada by voter initiative, and then most recently this past November in Massachusetts by 65% of the voters said, stop arresting marijuana smokers. Can you imagine 65%? That's a significant victory. So clearly things are back running in our direction again. But what we learned during that 18-year period was don't take anything for granted. If we were able to continue this momentum a number of years, say 5-6 years, I think we will legalize medical use in all states. I think we will stop arresting smokers in almost all states. There may still be a few southern states that are, you know, have their heads stuck in the sand. And I suspect we will begin to actually legalize marijuana, which is what I really want to speak about briefly. We are at a tipping point in this country where the debate has gone from marijuana doesn't lead to heroin and marijuana is not so bad and maybe marijuana helps a lot of seriously ill people to the point where maybe we should legalize, tax, and regulate marijuana. There were just hearings in the state of Massachusetts 2 weeks ago on a tax and regulate bill. I was happy to be up there to testify. There was just hearings last week in California, and there will be again in about 2 months on a bill by Tom Amiano from San Francisco to legalize marijuana in California, not medical use. This means everybody over the age of 21. You don't need a doctor. You don't have to fake like you're sick. It's just your right to be left alone. And there will be a third bill introduced in Oregon within about 2 weeks. So why are we now at this, what appears to be a tipping point? Let me give you 2 or 3 benchmarks. We did a Zogby poll maybe 6 months ago nationwide that showed for the first time 52% of the public say they would support legalizing, regulating, and taxing marijuana. That's not just decrim, legalization, 52%. In California, there was a field poll that's maybe 2 months old that found 56% of the people in California say legalize and tax marijuana. We now know, Terry made some reference to it, there are more living Americans who have smoked marijuana than who have not. The latest data on that is a little old now. It was a CNN Time magazine taken in December of 2002. When the government asks how many people have smoked marijuana, as you can imagine, people are less than honest. They get anywhere from 41 to 44%. You know, the government agent knocks on your door and say, by the way, do you ever smoke marijuana? Oh, no. When private surveyors ask the question, you still have some people who are less than honest, but more people are being willing to be honest. That survey in December of 2002 by Time and CNN found 47% of the public 7 years ago had said, yes, I smoked marijuana at some time in my life. Considering the number of older Americans who have since died, who generally weren't smokers, and the number of younger Americans who have now replaced them, I think without question, there are more living Americans who have smoked than who have not. Doesn't mean they're current smokers. Most of those people smoke for a few years. They go on with their lives and drop it. Maybe they come back. We're showing an uptick, by the way, in 60 and above smokers, which is, they call it the empty nesters. The kids are gone. They've completed college. They got a little time on their hands. They're semi-retired. Hey, isn't it fun? I kind of enjoyed that smoking. Maybe I'll try it again. I've had two friends call me. One of them was an original Nader's Raider, called me in the last year. Hadn't smoked in, I don't know, 30 years. Wanted to know where he could get some.
My 63-year-old brother-in-law asked me that.
Where can I get some weed? I said, go back to your old dealer. I don't know where the hell they get some. So a combination of the polling that shows a majority of the American public are now on our side, the reality that over half the living Americans in this country know that they smoked marijuana did not turn them into a criminal. They shouldn't have been arrested. They know that. It didn't mean they're pro-pot. It just means they know it's idiotic to make it a crime. So we're getting close. And more important are female voters. This used to be an issue that had strong support among males, much lower support among females. The last couple of years, that gap has been closing. I just saw one survey taken where I think there were only 2 points difference or something. Oh, wow. So that we have begun to pick up that terribly important second half the population, or even more than half the population in this country. So, again, there are three bills pending in Congress right now. One is to decriminalize marijuana up to 3.5 ounces. It's primarily sponsored by Barney Frank with 8 co-sponsors. It would also decriminalize...
Like Ron Paul, I said.
Well, Ron Paul is certainly one of them. It would eliminate all penalties for possession of up to 3.5 ounces of pot and for the not-for-profit transfer of up to 1 ounce of pot, because that's what consumers do. We buy pot and share it with our friends. There's no reason that should be a crime. So that's a good bill. It was only introduced last year. It's the first decrim bill that's been introduced since 1978. But it shows that even in Congress, they're beginning to open up. There's a medical use bill in Congress. It's been there for about 8 years. What that would do would simply back the federal government out so the states that wish to legalize medical use wouldn't have to worry about federal interference. We made major progress recently when the Obama administration announced, the Attorney General Holder actually made the announcement, but Obama had made this pledge during the campaign. If you're a provider or a caregiver or a patient that's authorized under a state law, the feds will no longer harass you. Under prior administrations, the federal government made a big deal that they don't recognize medical marijuana, and every so often they would go in. They didn't usually bother patients, but they bothered a lot of caregivers and growers, people who were growing for the patients. That's no longer there, and that gives states, for example, in Maine and in Rhode Island and in New Mexico, the latest three state medical use laws, they include the state licenses nonprofits now that will grow and sell the marijuana legally under state law to the authorized patients. So for all of these reasons, we're on a roll. I hope it continues for another 5 years, but no one knows how long it will. But I am convinced that our ability to get from where we are to where we need to be, which is we've won the hearts and minds of the American people, we have to figure out how to translate that into public policy. Women are going to be the key ingredient in how successful we are in that, and people like Jessica are going to show us the way.
As you can see, Keith's aging brain has not been addled by marijuana. He is quite articulate. Jessica, tell us what kind of headway you're making. I'll let you take this any direction you want. Inside the Republican Party, which is ideologically split among social cultural conservatives, Main Street, Wall Street, balanced budget conservatives, neocons, there are about 18 of them, and libertarian conservatives, some of whom have been leaving the Republican Party. Is this a gateway back?
Let's hope so. I'm all about a gateway if that's what it does. I, too, have heard stories.
A gateway like drug, yeah.
The one about, older people taking it up. I went to a friend's birthday party. She's 75. She whispered to me. I was sitting next to her. She goes, I just want you to know I'm going to start doing pot again when I turn 80. Such an awesome woman. So I wanted to touch just briefly on a couple things, and then I'll talk about the GOP. Yep. So the day after Obama came out and said that, you know, we're no longer going to raid dispensaries and growers and patients in states where medical marijuana is legal, my husband got calls from 14 different dispensaries. The DEA had come in and raided them. So there is a conflict between the federal government, within the federal government right now, because there are a lot of jobs on the state, billions of dollars. And I don't want to be so cynical, to say that people in the DA don't believe in what they're doing. I'm sure there's great people. I have wonderful friends on all sides of this issue. But we have to also take into account, and I hope you will in your reporting, what is the incentive for the average DEA agent to keep marijuana illegal? Ask those types of questions. So one of the things I want you to touch on is this decriminalization versus legalization conversation, because I think that's something that reporters often confuse. Like I had a question yesterday from a reporter, well, why not just decriminalize? I mean, isn't that enough? Why legalize? And so maybe you can touch on that. And so when it comes to Republicans, I find it's just so incredibly ironic, because the reason why we go out and shoot our guns, and another thing I actually support is, if you want to have an AK-47 in your house, lock it up. Don't let your kids get to it, but have it. I don't care. Law-abiding people aren't the ones the people who register their guns aren't the ones going out and shooting people. So anyway, that being said, Republicans are all about the Second Amendment, and they say they need it because we need to be concerned about government power. And yet we look at the power that we give to the government on this issue. We give the government the power to drug test our children without our consent in our schools. I just talked to a friend who works at Johns Hopkins Hospital, and she drove me to the train station this morning, and she was telling me she gets drug tested all the time. And if she showed up positive for alcohol, fine, whatever. We assume you did it on your
own. The Washington Post, the New York Times, drug test people. And I did,
after you
internships.
Told me that. Oh, for internships. Wow. After you told me that, I checked. The Denver Post does not drug test, so I can continue my subscription. but, you know, we have doctors, anesthesiologists in this country walking around with fentanyl pumps in their feet. We have in Colorado, like in 13 other states, we see that accidental prescription drug overdoses are now the number one killer, accidental killer. More than accidental car deaths, which, of course, frequently include alcohol. This is important to me because I believe the greatest threat in terms of drug abuse and likely fatalities for my children are them pulling OxyContin out of some parent's medical cabinet or morphine or any of the other dozens of drugs that I've been prescribed for my 15 surgeries. So when I speak to Republicans, I try to remind them not only of the foundation of what we are as a party, but also the practical, scientific, fiscal, and policy aspects of this issue. And it is a process. Having gone through DARE, I'm still waiting for that moment when I start to see dancing bunnies and three screens of the same image spread before me like they told us all. I'm still waiting for that person to walk up to me on a playground and give me a sticker and put it in my mouth and start seeing, you know, The Wizard of Oz or whatever. And I think the problem here is that there was so much propaganda, and I love Ronald Reagan. I have his photo in my entryway. Great man. But his wife was wrong. And especially when it comes to marijuana, it takes time to work through all the propaganda that our tax dollars have spent on re-educating our children with half-truths and falsehoods when it comes to this issue. So when I talk to Republicans, it's a very gradual process. I start out by saying, I don't want my kids to smoke pot any more than you do. But don't you admit, or don't you agree, rather, that every day as parents, when our kids make a mistake, we try to get them to admit it, learn why they did it, and not make that same mistake. And yet our government, through the drug war, through this second round of prohibition, has not been able to admit that it has made a mistake and it has failed, and now is the time for new policy. So this isn't about, when I speak to Republicans, this isn't about endorsing marijuana use. It's saying, how do we best tackle drug use by juveniles? And when it comes to having that conversation, should we put marijuana at the top of the list? When we look at the emerging science that's coming out, the answer is unequivocally no. Study after study or survey after survey finds that marijuana is far more accessible to the average high school student than alcohol. And that may scare a lot of parents. It scares me because I know where I live in urban Denver, we have $3 million houses and we have $300 a month migrant farm workers all within three blocks. It's an amazing picture, Adams Morgan-ish kind of neighborhood. Lots of Ethiopian restaurants and things like that. And so I face a scenario where my kids could get pot off the street or whatever else. Somebody hands it to them. I've seen people selling pot right behind my house. And obviously that's a fear. I think if we regulate, legalize, control the potency, those are all things that parents should support. But we need to prioritize when it comes to these issues. And what I was I lost my train of thought there for a second, but science coming out of California, and I think is it UC San Diego, shows that alcohol has a far more detrimental effect on juvenile brain development than marijuana. And that's a huge breakthrough because we've known that for a long time when it comes to adult brains, but the juvenile brain seems to have a similar impact. So we need to really encourage our government to look at these issues, and also reporters. How many of you see yourselves as ideological versus sort of a neutral reporter? So who? How many of you have partisan bent, or you see yourself going more in an issue of, in the direction of advocacy? We can cover his eyes. Just don't tell him you're going to law school.
No, no.
Okay, so raise him high. So ideological, and then the rest of you want to be reporters, right?
Well, I think maybe what they thought you were asking me, because I asked this at the beginning of each class, is how many people admit to being liberal or conservative or Democrat or Republican. I'm not sure that most of you are intending to do ideological opinion writing as opposed to straight news writing, but I'm curious how many of you see your main interest as doing some kind of opinion or advocacy writing or reporting. Okay, so I think they were sort of admitting they have ideological prejudices.
Okay, well, good for you. Because you everybody has biases.
You can guess, Jessica, what prejudices most of them have.
All conservative.
Oh, yeah.
But what does that even mean? I mean, really. So, I'll try and wrap up here, but the last thing is that while these same surveys that Keith referenced show that close to or even more than half of all American adults support legalization to some degree, whether we legalize and don't do anything with the taxes, we limit regulation, or we have a full-on regulatory scheme similar to alcohol. What we find in these same polls is that there's a tremendous ideological and partisan divide. Some of them show that up to 70% of Republicans remain opposed to legalization. That being said, after really coming out on this issue in the last couple of years, and more importantly, in the last couple of months, as it's marijuana has taken the headlines. In Colorado, every single day for the past 2 weeks, there has been a front page or highly placed article concerning marijuana legalization and or medical marijuana. This is a huge issue, especially in the West. But after I did this Fox interview last Sunday, I get out of the studio and I turn on my phone and there's 50 emails. 50 in the span of about 7 minutes. It got so big at one point in one single 1 hour period, I received 200 emails. The vast majority coming from Republicans, more conservative than me, saying you're right. We are wrong on this issue as a party. We are only going to reclaim voters if we stay true to the base, the foundation of our party, which is that we trust the government more, or we trust the people more than the government to make the decisions in their lives. That we fear government power. We fear it when it comes to the Second Amendment. We fear it when it comes to the Fifth Amendment. And we sure as heck fear it when it comes to marijuana or any sort of prohibition. So I have been utterly, completely shocked in terms of the incredible response I've received. World War II veteran from Oklahoma, a self-described evangelical stay-at-home mom in Arkansas, Southern Baptist, a Bush Houston prominent fundraiser, graduate students. I mean, it's across the demographic profile in terms of what these people do, but they all describe themselves as Republicans and or conservative Republicans.
The interesting thing about this is that in many ways there has been a collusion of the left and the right. On the left, you have baby boom parents who want the government to parent for them, protect their children from marijuana. And on the right, you've had social cultural conservatives who somehow think this is a demon drug. Keith, talk a little bit, if you would, and again, I'll let you both take it whatever direction you want. You have lobbied, been in a lot of congressional offices. This is a third rail to most politicians. They're scared to death to do anything that even appears to be sanctioning drug use. We had the idiot congressman from Indiana, Mark Souter, want to take away your student loans if you had ever even been arrested or charged with marijuana possession. What did people tell you in private, these members of Congress?
I very seldom talk to a member or a senior staffer who privately would say that we're thrilled about locking up marijuana smokers or we're thrilled about spending all this law enforcement resources arresting all these nonviolent offenders. They know just as we do that's not good policy, but as Terry mentioned, they've been schooled in the belief that it is truly the third rail of politics, because during the 80s, there's no doubt about it, there were lots of elected officials who got defeated for re-election because their challenger went further to the right than they did. That is, they accused the office holder of being soft on crime and drugs. Now, what the hell that's supposed to mean? Think about those who are soft on crime. The verb's wrong.
And remember, in the 80s, you won't remember this, you're too young, because there was a conflation of drugs and crime because of the epidemic of crack,
yeah.
Cocaine by another name. And there was a huge age cohort because of just age distribution of young, aggressive males who were involved in crime. There's always this conflation that somehow drugs equal crime.
Yeah. And as a result, they learned their lesson well. Even people who were openly progressive were generally frightened to be open about their position on legalizing and decriminalizing marijuana. And you can imagine what those people who were in the middle or on the right of the spectrum, they almost didn't want to hear the M word. In fact, we used to hear the L word was the expression. They didn't even talk about legalization. It was as if that were a curse word. It was the L word. You weren't even supposed to speak it out loud. Now, that's changed to some degree. It changes more quickly on the state level than at the federal level because the state elected officials are generally younger. They're a little more in touch with what's happening on the home front. People in Washington, as I think by now you certainly must know, get pretty insulated. And so, without doubt, it's going to be a few more years before Congress is going to seriously consider these proposals that we now have pending, even though it is nice that at least we have them out there. They give cover for these state legislators. The other thing that's helped is we've had the ability to occasionally run a voter initiative on either medical use or decrim, and we've only lost one so far. We lost in, was it Utah or
Nevada?
Yeah, it was, by only a couple of percentage points. We just lost by hair. In every other state where medical use has been on the ballot, we've won it. In Michigan, not exactly a terribly liberal state, Michigan passed it, I think, 63% last year. For total, a good medical marijuana bill. On decrim, Massachusetts just passed it with 65%. Well, what generally happens is once those elected officials, both in Congress and at home, see the voters actually walked up to the polls and pulled a lever that said, yes, I want to do it, all of a sudden, now you can have that discussion with them that you could never have. And that's why this year, for the first time, we have three bills talking about legalization on the state level. Also, as long as they thought that the federal government would simply enjoin a state law that went too far, and remember, because of the Supremacy Clause, if a state and federal law are in direct conflict, now that's a legal phrase, it doesn't mean the common phrase, but if they're what's considered in a direct conflict, then the federal law, the Supremacy Clause kicks in, the federal law reigns, and the state law is ruled unconstitutional. So for state legislators who were already nervous about supporting a bill of ours, to do something which their colleagues and their staff were saying, Bush administration is simply going to come in and join that the first month. Why take that kind of political baggage if it's not even going to change policy? Because of the Obama announcement, and I certainly agree with Jessica, it's not as simple and as complete as some people thought. What that announcement said, you have to be operating absolutely under the terms of the state law, and if you're not completely, then they still feel free to come after you if they want. And frankly, a lot of the dispensaries, certainly in California, are not technically legal. We're at a place now where those state legislators at least don't have to worry that the current federal government is going to come in and complicate their life. If they've got the courage and if they've seen a vote in their state or a neighboring state that shows a majority of Americans are moving in our direction, it gives them a lot of political courage. So I believe we're close to overcoming that third rail position. But, I mean, it'll always be there to some degree. It's sort of like if you're a libertarian and you're being asked to, maybe you're being asked to take a position on the death penalty, and if you're really opposed to the death penalty and somebody has committed a vicious crime, man, that's tough to come out for an elected official like the sniper right now. The governor of Virginia has to pardon him today or he's going to be executed tonight. Well, I can't imagine he's going to pardon him. It would take enormous courage in the state of Virginia to pardon a man who, I don't know how many, 10, 12, 15 people he murdered or something in a short period of time. So there are always these contentious issues are going to be a little more difficult than, say, regular economic issues or regular union policy issues or something like this, because they still carry in some people's mind a sense of morality. And as long as marijuana is considered sinful or immoral, there are going to be a lot of elected officials that simply aren't going to be willing to take a position. But let me remind you how gambling was. When I was growing up, you could only legally gamble in Vegas. Then they added New Jersey. But the rest of the country, they knew they could make money on legalized gambling, but it was sinful. We couldn't dare do that. Well, today you go out in the Midwest, you go on the Mississippi. You can't gamble on land in Missouri, but you go out in the middle of the Mississippi River, and you got several different river boats you can go on and gamble, and they're only too happy to take that tax money. The morality gradually fails on most of these issues. The reality of the tax revenue becomes important, and that is what you're seeing with marijuana. Less and less, even if someone doesn't like marijuana, doesn't choose to smoke marijuana, they don't generally hold it against their neighbor or a colleague or a friend who does. They don't see it as a morality issue. And so we will, I think, over the next few years, benefit enormously as it becomes less emotionally laden with morality and sinfulness, and more directly a look at how much money could we raise. Right now, there's a number of studies on tax revenue. One of them shows the states could raise $31 billion this year, and that's even assuming a standard sales tax. You wouldn't have a sales tax. It would be far more than that. Marijuana sells, good marijuana, I doubt if I'm telling you anything you don't know, but from $300 to $600 now, it's occasionally even more. It costs, we have asked experts who've testified that if you didn't run from the police, if you're free to just grow it, it wouldn't be more than $25 an ounce. Well, none of us are suggesting that a state legalize marijuana and have a fire sale, you know, so all of a sudden marijuana is $50 an ounce in California. That probably wouldn't be in the interest of public health. It certainly wouldn't be politically popular. So they're going to, if they legalize it, they're going to sell it for $300 or $400 an ounce. They're going to try to undercut the black market. All but $25 of that is profit. So, again, the official state estimate is California would make $4.1 billion the first year they legalized it. They would probably make more like $50 billion.
And undercutting the black market is absolutely key here, because not only is there a conflation with morality, there's a conflation with violent crime. Look how these drugs cause all this murder in Mexico or drug cartels in Colombia. The crime is caused by the black market that jacks up the price so that people are willing to die and kill in order to make these huge profits. It is such a simple concept that people almost willfully have to misunderstand it. Jessica?
Just building on that, my husband is an attorney who specializes in medical marijuana and helping patients and also business people set up dispensaries. And he's had a couple clients murdered, and it's all the result of international drug cartels who don't like the competition. So it's very sad that we haven't been able to learn our lesson.
And it's not just murder and crime. It is also official corruption. And that official corruption we see unbelievably in Mexico, but it is in the United States too. There is a huge amount of official crime among police departments on this. And there's the other thing, and read Radley Balco of Reason.com and Reason Magazine, and he's talking about the increased militarization of our police departments. Policing agencies are not supposed to be paramilitary units, but we have given them a huge amount of money to buy their toys, the battering ram things going in with guns blazing in the guise of protecting the public from marijuana users and marijuana dealers or other drug users and dealers. That is a huge problem, because we have seen literally hundreds of innocent bystanders killed with these military police operations.
And when you cover this issue as a reporter, I would encourage you to look critically at multiple things. And I'm just going to throw those out there really quickly. You'll always see in any sort of article about a violent death or murder or some sort of car accident, whatever, reporters will always inject marijuana as part of that conversation. But marijuana, in fact, again, to get back to the science, does not make people violent. It doesn't cause people to beat their wives. I would say the vast majority of people should not physically drive don't physically have the capability to drive when using marijuana. And 100% of people should not, regardless. But that being said, look critically at the role that marijuana plays in whatever scene it is that you're covering, because oftentimes you'll hear there was marijuana there. Well, yeah, there was also, you know, an ice luge and 14 bottles of vodka and whatever else. And so when we, as reporters, cover these issues, there's an abundance of emphasis, an unfair emphasis on marijuana in terms of causation before the facts are known.
And police love to take along reporters on drug busts. In 1972, I wrote a story for the Champaign News Gazette on 40 police descending on a teenage so-called pot party in a little town. They ended up putting the teenagers in handcuffs. They found one drug, tonsillitis pills. And this was, the sheriff told me he loved these things. He's going to do them again. They love to take you along to show you their drug bust.
The other part of it, too, is that look at the alleged criminal and or victim. My husband is very controversial amongst many criminal defense attorneys because he, with the client consent and interest, will put his client out there. People like 50-year-old Damian Lagoy, who weighs 90 pounds, has full-blown AIDS and Hep C, gets arrested for using marijuana improperly under the state's medical marijuana statute because he had a caregiver who had too many patients. Is this the type of person we want in our criminal justice system? Look at the people. Start to ask questions. Who was it who was arrested? They'll often say, you know, 24-year-old man arrested for da-la-la-la, he had 40 pounds of pot. Look at the person. My husband's had other cases, one where a guy was teaching. He was volunteering at a ski resort. Snowboarder comes, nails him in the back. He was helping the victim was helping young kids. Learn to ski, disabled kids, gets nailed in the back by a snowboarder, permanent injuries. He's now in a wheelchair. He gets nailed for putting his marijuana, what do you want to call it? The parts you can't use. I know nothing about pot, but parts of the plant that you can't, the non
stems, seeds,
yeah, thank you. In his trash can inside his house, so he's arrested. And most recently, my husband had a case where a woman was 8 months pregnant, was a caregiver, but she had violated, which is really an interpretive rulemaking by the state health board. And in all of those cases, my husband ultimately was successful, which is terrific. But I would really encourage you as reporters to look critically at this. The next thing real quickly, I mean, 5 years or 3 years ago, if I talked to a reporter about this, they would have been like, yeah, man, getting baked, da, 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 da. Like it was this funny Jerry Garcia moment. That has changed dramatically, and I think it's changed in part because people are talking to reporters. When I talk to a reporter and they pull that, I say, you think this is funny? Because to me, sending 850,000 people into our criminal justice system every year for a substance less harmful than alcohol, that's not funny. And I go into my other things. But I encourage you to think
it's
seriously about
this. It's not particularly
this.
Funny in California, for example, where the prison guards union opposed medical marijuana because they'd have fewer people to guard, the second most powerful union in California.
Wow. Recently, I was interviewed by a reporter from a lifestyle magazine in Denver. I think this was a feature with my husband and me as the Republican potheads or whatever. And
Stiletto stoners.
Stiletto stoners. So 5 minutes into it, the guy pulls out his medical marijuana card, and it turned into a legal consultation. This guy was like, so, you're an attorney. What do I do on this and this and this? So we've seen a dramatic shift from when it was this funny ha-ha thing to very self-interested in reporters. And just as I would encourage you to not accept the propaganda from our side, don't accept or acknowledge your own biases. You know, where have you come to this? What does it mean that because when you were 20 you did you know, a big fat bong head at a frat party or whatever. How does that shape your worldview? Because I think if we can take the emotion out of it, everybody's emotion, left, right, center, libertarian, green, whatever, and just look at the facts, the vast majority of Americans, and hopefully in the long term our elected officials, will come to the same conclusion.
Let's take your questions.
Can I make one real quick thing? One point she made, I want to give you a local example because I suspect all of you may have seen it. Less than a year ago, we had a terrible case here of where a woman, I think it was reasonably early in the morning with three nephews and nieces or I don't know, something, went the wrong way on a one-way road in Maryland, had a head-on collision, killed two people in the other case. So something like 8-9 people died. It was a terrible case. There was just Sunday in the paper a summary that as the test came back, she had tested positive for marijuana. Now, it didn't suggest she was impaired. That was a urine test, you can be sure. That's almost always what they give. It does not measure impairment. The THC molecules adhere to the fatty tissue in the body, and if you're a regular smoker, you will test positive for up to 6 weeks after you last smoked. You're impaired for about 2 hours, and I agree with Jessica.
That's a huge part of reporting.
Do not smoke and drive right afterwards. You don't drive as poorly as an alcohol drinker does, but that's not the standard. The standard is you don't want to drive when you're impaired. So I have no way of knowing if this woman were impaired, although I kind of doubt it because it was in the morning and she had all her kids and stuff with her. But this newspaper, I think it was Wire Service that the Post picked up on, was suggesting that because there was THC in her system, that might have been the cause of the crash. If they want to find that out, they do a blood test. There you can measure the THC, and in the blood, if you got, I think it's over 5 nanograms, you're impaired. You shouldn't be driving. But urine tests mean nothing. So, it means something. It means you smoked sometime in the last 6 weeks. But be cognizant of the difference those tests tell, because for most journalists, they don't understand that difference, and they assume if somebody's got THC in their system, they must have been stoned. Not true at all. Sorry.
That's a huge one, especially as we talk about what legalization and regulation means. I mean, when you're covering a marijuana DUI trial and the issue is intoxication, well, can this marijuana be in the person's system? How long has it been in the system? Are you buying the DA's expert witness? Are you buying the defense? Look critically at it and make sure to get as many facts as you can when it comes to the science.
This happens all the time because you may have a mixture of drugs in your body and you may have some trace of MDMA or trace of THC. You might have done a lot of crystal meth. You might also be really drunk,
yeah,
which is probably the cause of it. Your questions.
You were talking about a little bit about how some people, after you appeared on that Fox interview, were, from the conservative part of the Republican Party, were really open to it. How far up has that gone? Have you met with bigger leaders in the Republican Party that seem open to this, or is this more of a grassroots within the party?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because I have been encouraged time and again by those within my political party, including people from the last gubernatorial administration, calling me up and politely encouraging me to write my professional eulogy. Meanwhile, those same people accept campaign contributions that come from a household where the mortgage is paid fighting prohibition. So there's incredible hypocrisy. And often I will hear from Democrats, well, how can you be a Republican? Your party is so insane on this issue. They don't value freedom. They've abandoned their roots. And my response is, first, I'm fighting to reclaim what's right. And what's right is limited government and personal responsibility and individual rights. I'm not giving up yet. It's sort of like a church to me or a family. I believe in it. I grew up with it. It's who I am. The second part of it is, what have Democrats done for me lately? To be blunt, I think Barack Obama's response with saying we're not going to rate dispensaries was weak. I think his lack of response to what the DA has done subsequently is negligent. And
his drug czar, am I not wrong, has said there is no medical use of marijuana.
Yes. That's unfortunately true. He was the chief of police in Seattle, made not a single arrest. We have that Seattle Hemp Fest where you have 90,000 people a day for 2 days, at least 50% are openly smoking, haven't had an arrest 5-6 years, and he was asked by the Seattle Times or whatever the paper is, that he was asked, how come there's no marijuana arrests? And he said, to his credit, The voters of Seattle passed an initiative that said marijuana offenses should be the lowest possible priority, and they are. So he was a terrific chief of police, but he comes out here and he falls into the same mm-hmm. game where he feels he has to propagandize. So
we had a similar situation in Denver where my husband was the keynote speaker at the 420 rally. I'm sure you've seen these where exactly 420, certain something happens. First year he was a speaker at 421. The second year he learned and went at 419. But I don't. Estimates vary. It's between 7 and 10,000 people there. Clouds of pot smoke. The first year cops were arresting people right and left. Second year, no arrests. Unless you were outrageous, getting in a cop's face or hurting somebody, and none of that happened. There were, at least to my knowledge, we checked the records the next day. There may have been some arrests that we couldn't find or something, but there was nothing directly attributable either to marijuana use that day or to anything that went on with that rally. So law enforcement, and I think if you talk to the vast majority of law enforcement officers, they are with us because they don't want to be going and arresting.
There's actually a sheriff in Colorado in Telluride County, yeah. Bill McMasters, who has written a book for legalization. I assume he's still a sheriff. I don't know that.
I think he's retired now.
Yeah,
but
I think he is.
I was sitting at a certain event in Aspen where people enjoy cannabis-glazed apple cobbler from one of the town's most exclusive chefs, sitting between a certain sheriff and a certain newspaper editor who will remain nameless, forgetting that I'm pregnant and I'm the token Republican non-smoking mom. The token non-token girl. Okay, so passing a joint back and forth, and I just thought, here you have head law enforcement, head report. Like you said, I mean, I want to say, people say, is this the tipping point, or as Kathleen Parker put it, the token point? I want to believe that we're there, but that being said, you never know. I mean, something could happen tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, look at how it's laughed off on late-night talk shows. You know, Jay Leno was always joking about his band leader. I don't know if he's still his band leader on the new show or not. It's constantly laughed about. It is so insinuated into the popular culture to even imagine why the hell it's still illegal is mind-boggling, but then it goes right back to the third rail argument. Until politicians see somebody who is defeated because he supported legalization,
prohibition. Yeah.
Prohibition, nothing's going to change. It's just not. Politicians don't take this kind of risk until they see the popular culture move so far in a direction that they no longer can resist.
I have another question. I know that a lot of the religious rights grip on the Republican Party comes from they vote in large groups. Do a lot of marijuana users vote in large numbers, or is that kind of missing from your movement right now?
I think historically, too many marijuana smokers have not been involved in the political process. I think coming out of the late 60s and the 70s, there was this sense that if you were a marijuana smoker, you were anti-government, or you were kind of off. If you weren't a hippie, at least you were not in the mainstream. And as a result, you sort of were taught, don't waste your time voting. Well, of course, that's the stupidest thing in the world. If you don't vote, you're obviously part of the problem. I do believe we're doing better at it now. I certainly, every speech I give, and I know Jessica, I literally say, if you don't vote, folks, don't complain about getting busted, because that's why we've still got these laws. Is we've got enough public support to win, but we haven't made that known to our elected officials. It's one thing to contact an elected official and let them know of a position that you have that may not be that popular, but it's quite another one to let them know that you're breaking the law. That scares the hell out of people. So I actually still talk to members or legislative offices where they don't think they have very many marijuana smokers in their district because we're not visible. They've learned they have gay people because the gay issue has forced its way even in conservative districts. But there are still a lot of congressional districts where they can't point to a single major contributor there is who's ever acknowledged they smoke marijuana. Well, clearly, we don't want everybody to come out of the closet and lose their job. But we sure as hell want people to stand up if they can do it without losing their job and say, look, I work hard, I vote, I raise a family, I contribute in a positive way to my community, but I smoke marijuana when I relax in the evening. That's the only point we're trying to make, is that we're just average citizens, and I don't think we've quite gotten to where we need to be. But that's part of the problem.
One of the things that I said at a speech in March, which was perhaps more controversial than I meant, intended, which is bad as a former press secretary, right? But I said, put away the bongs and the tie-dye, put on a suit and lawyer up and get your ass down to the Capitol.
And by the way, if you notice, my whole life, I went to law school, I tell people it's a uniform I was taught we had to wear when we graduated law school. So although I understand in your position it's nice not to wear, I wear a coat and tie 6 days a week.
Get
now,
on a tie.
I have gotten to
wear.
Oh,
no, I have no reason to have that uniform here.
But I do it because I know that every office I go to or every visitor that comes to the normal office has a stereotypical thing in their mind. They expect I'm going to be some, I don't know, long-haired hippie with bell-bottoms, I guess we used to call them, or something. No, I mean, for most marijuana smokers, it's not the central thing in their lives. They have families and jobs and morals they care about, and I'm the same way. So if wearing a coat and tie helps some of those people get over their stereotypes, I'm only too happy to do it.
It's important, yeah.
Who asked that question? Okay.
Where do y'all stand on legalization and decriminalization of other drugs?
Well, for normal, we only focus on marijuana. We always have. We knew at the time that it was the one drug that was used by large numbers of people. If you actually look at the numbers of illicit drug users in this country, there was a period where cocaine was up a bit. It's way down. I don't know. Maybe it's 200,000 in the whole country or something. Maybe 400,000. It's not big. Heroin users, much smaller than even that. Amphetamines, nothing significant. So in terms of the sheer numbers of people it impacts, we only focus on marijuana. Now, I'm quick to tell anybody who asks me, I think we ought to decriminalize all drugs. And that is, don't treat a drug user as a criminal, but I sure as hell would not favor legalization. If by that you mean, do we want stores selling cocaine and heroin and amphetamines? No, I don't think we do at all. But when someone is caught who's having a problem with their drug use, either at work or whatever the situation, let's give them some help. Let's not treat them like a criminal. You don't get help when you get thrown in jail, guys. If you don't know that, they don't have a doctor come in and talk to you about drug counseling. You know, you're worried about how long you're going to be in there and who your roommate is and whether you're going to get violently attacked, just like anybody else in jail is worried. So I would favor decriminalizing all drugs. I would not legalize any of the current illicit drugs other than marijuana.
Some of us strongly disagree with that, believe in legalization.
There are lots of groups like LEAP, for example, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. They favor legalizing all drugs. I mean, there's an argument for it. I certainly wouldn't fight it if some state decided to experiment with a couple of those, and let's just see how they work. But in terms of the impact on the criminal justice system and on people's lives, it'll only impact a relatively small number of people.
There are a couple of other organizations involved with this. Family, you mentioned Families Against
Mandatory.
This is started by a woman whose, I think, brother had been given, thrown into prison for...
I think he served 10 years or something.
For something minor. And then Law Enforcement Against Prohibition are almost entirely former law enforcement officers. Sitting law enforcement officers find it difficult to join. I think there may be a few. There's a couple of principal organizations. There's the Marijuana Policy Project. There's the Drug Policy Alliance.
Students for Sensible Drug Policy.
They were created to oppose Mark Souter's insanity, taking away your student loans if you were ever charged.
That is a huge issue, by the way, the student loan issue.
Yeah. What else am I missing?
I think you got most of them.
Most of the major organizations.
Republican mother, Republican pothead moms. We haven't really worked on gotten through the branding yet.
RPMs? Yeah, okay.
Alex? I have a couple comments. First, I assume both of you heard about the story in Portugal where
they legalized all drugs.
Or legalized all drugs, right?
Small quantities, I think.
Yeah, and I just kind of, I wanted your thoughts on that, if that sort of has any impact around here. Secondly, I just have a question for you. Why use the Republican sort of platform as the vehicle to sort of bring this issue forth? Because I don't see the Republican Party as like, I mean, maybe in their ideal days they would be, but I don't see them as sort of a vehicle to personal liberties or especially, you know, on social policy issues. And so, like, to come in through the sort of Republican side is an interesting tactic, and I was just wondering if it's even more difficult than if doing it through the Democrat.
I'm glad you brought that up. First off, I will never be a Democrat, never. And I have so many people. The next person who says this to me is just going to get hit in the head. You're a Democrat. You just don't know you are. After being a U.S. Senate press secretary, getting my graduate degree in government, having been a political strategist for the last 10 years, pretty sure I know what I am. You know, I'm okay with it. I'm open with it. But that being said, I'm adamantly opposed to affirmative action. And I was going to go down this road. And it's funny to me that because Keith and I have the same views on this issue, but because I'm a girl and I'm a mom and I'm a Republican, it's Fox News or Washington Post that wants to pick it up. So I've struggled with that. I'm like, well, what does this mean for my identity? I don't want to be patted on the head as a woman. I think it's the irony. And I talked briefly about that.
Does that help? The irony.
It's yes, because it's the irony. Oh, my God, Republican. You know, it's like anything you find on YouTube.
Whose minds do you need to open more?
And so when I look at my party and you look, and I would encourage you both all today, this is your homework. Everyone write it down. Go and look at the Republican Party platform and the Democratic Party platform. And see how the parties have both in the respective ways, like any valuable organization or institution, have failed. And where have they failed the most? And I believe that the Libertarian Party, which is now, what, 30 years old? I spoke at their convention last summer. They had Hooters waitresses. It was great. I covered the Democrats' convention for NBC, and they had condoms. And the Republicans, we were handing out copies of the Federalist Papers. It's not going to sell well. So on this... we talk about the Federalist Papers and about the need for freedom and the Second Amendment and the Fifth Amendment, property rights, another huge issue, right? Parents, parental choice and education, religious freedom, the First Amendment. And yet, when it comes to one of the most important parenting decisions, most important educational decisions, we have the DARE program, which encourages students to inform upon their parents, Soviet style. When we talk about property rights and having the right to defend your home from government intrusion, we talk about all those foundations of the Republican Party. We then turn a blind eye to what is one of the most major consistent abuses of all of these constitutional rights. So
this is not a left-right issue. There is collusion of the left and the right on this. You take a look at Democrats who would defend to the death your right to cut a future child from your body will tell you you cannot put marijuana into your body.
Charlie Ringel.
The inconsistency of that on First Amendment grounds is awesome. The same thing is true, as Jessica has pointed out, the Republican
Party. I live in a very liberal, yuppie neighborhood where I hang out with all the other overeducated moms, and occasionally we bring out the Pinot Grigio for the playdates, la, la, la. And the liberals in the group are more opposed to legalization than I am, or any of the, we're split kind of 50-50, half of us are liberal, half self-described, what is liberal conservative, I'm sure that's a topic for another day. That being said, Obama supporters with their bumper stickers in the back of their hybrid SUVs, and these are the people who are opposed to it.
Obama, at the town meeting, if you recall, this spring, laughed off the marijuana legalization question. It is not a left-right issue. It is collusion of the left and
also,
right.
By the way, I do think there's, if you're a single-issue person, I am, and some of us work on projects where by definition we are, then you might well go for the most comfortable platform. For me, at Liberal Democrats, because we didn't have a lot of support early on, they were the only support we had. But for most people, they've got a range of issues that are important to them, and I know that's true for Jessica. She didn't become an adult caring only about the marijuana issue. So you can't expect people to give up everything else they stand for just because there's one issue you disagree with your colleague. So it's terribly important from our standpoint that we have people in every political constituency for whom this issue is important. We cannot win it otherwise.
The movement has grown up. When I first started coming to fundraisers and things 4 or 5 years ago, 6 years ago now, there were all these references to the Bushies and those idiots who voted for Bush and those stupid pro-lifers and this and that. I mean, I'm, you know, overstating it a little bit, but there was no welcome mat. Now, there is a welcome mat, thanks in large part to people like Keith, who say, look, we're not going to win this if we keep preaching to the choir.
Yeah. We have time for one more question. Anybody got one last one? No.
Let's see, I forget the name of this alternative weekly in Colorado, but I know that they were at least looking for a reviewer for who would write a column about, I think, pot dispensaries or
medical
something.
Medical pot, yeah.
Right, and so what do you think about that? Do you think that's a signal that people are becoming more open about the discussion, or do you think it's going to, you know, get other people to be more open about, you know, talking about these kinds of things? or?
Well, interestingly, they called me and offered me the job to be the reviewer.
Oh,
and
really?
I turned it down, and next thing I was in the New York Times, I'm like, damn, my moment of glory, it's gone. No, but I think it's sort of tongue-in-cheek, being very good friends with the editor. It's kind of like, you know, we're going to go check it out. And part of the reason I turned down the job, obviously, is because I can't test the product. But there are abuses of the medical marijuana system, so I hope that, and actually my husband right now is starting a business association where there will be internal monitoring, you know, sort of a consumer safety person who goes around. Ralph Nader would be proud to make sure that quality control and all of the legal procedures are followed to give legitimacy to the movement. But when we talk about the media and how they cover it, Westward's awesome. I mean, liberal, Democrat editor, one of my good friends. But the entire back page just, well, we don't have medical marijuana in Washington, D.C., but I mean, if the any of the alternative weeklies, if you can envision,
there was an attempt.
The last four pages are all medical marijuana advertising. So how does that shape the coverage?
There was a marijuana initiative on the ballot in Washington, D.C. The Congress would not allow the results to be reported.
98. And by the way, it passed with 65 or something support of the vote, but they were smart enough, the people behind it. It was Wayne Turner and ACT UP that were the primary people behind it. In D.C., as you may or may not know, when our city council or our citizens vote on something, it doesn't become law automatically because we're not a state. It gets referred to Congress, and they have 30 days. That's 30 legislative days, so it's about...
You're going to see that on gay marriage. They're going to pass it.
Yeah, you're going to see it very soon here,
exactly.
Where they have a chance to override it.
Yeah.
Well, what happened in 98 after the vote passed, the leaders in Congress just made a public statement. You send it to us, and it's dead. So the people behind it were smart enough. They didn't transfer it. Legally, we have an opinion now that it's been sitting on the shelf since 98 and is available, and the current city council is expected over the coming weeks. They're going to take that 98 vote and transfer it to the Congress, and let's see. I mean, you know, frankly, my guess is they'll once again override it, but I'm not certain they will. So we may eventually have medical marijuana without any further action.
Let me make one last comment to you. In your newsrooms, I would suggest, because I believe this is a First Amendment issue, first and foremost, challenge your newspapers, news organizations that drug test employees, challenge them to stop using, without critical assessment, claims by law enforcement agencies was when they do drug busts and how much the street value of it was. Challenge them on everything they do, in my view, to collude with the drug war, because the interpreters of reality are also standing in the way of any reform of this neo-prohibition.
I have one last note on the drug prices. So you'll hear often law enforcement say there was $30 million of marijuana caught. I have no idea how far that would stand up. But, you know, they always put the guns and the money and they lay everything out like we're in Colombia. Well, my husband was the first lawyer that we know of in America that actually got the DEA to return property. Well, there's an obligation similar under the state level to protect property. Well, the DEA had all of the... growing material, growing equipment. God, I got to learn the terminology, like the hydroponics and stuff.
Hydroponics.
And the local law enforcement officials had the actual marijuana. Well, it had died because apparently, and some of it was missing. And so my husband said, okay, we want our pot back. You've trashed it. What's the street value of this? And so they're getting, defense attorneys are now using those government numbers against them, which are 30, 40, 50% higher than the street value. So we are going to see taxpayers paying for the government's overinflated prices of these drugs as well.
Thank you very much, Jessica. Thank you very much,
Keith.
I appreciate it.